The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made a start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Monday Space Show program, and I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for your call. Interesting program with Dr. Doug Plata today. A couple of announcements. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223, and no call screeners, and we're looking forward to your calls. Remember, that is the preferable way to communicate with our guest and with me as well on the show. If you want to use email, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Excuse me. And then you can post on our blog through our website, which is thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right, and you'll see upcoming shows. That's a menu item. And this is the first one listed, which is also the blog page for our program with Dr. Doug Plata. And then you can scroll down and post a comment that way, and we will get it almost immediately, and I will integrate it up into the show. But again, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. To go to the website, thespaceshow.com. So a couple of things to draw to your attention. There is a upper left menu, so listen live gives you all of the information on how to listen to a live show, an archive show, a podcasting show, and also if you're using Alexa, how to do that with our embedded tune-in player. And you're welcome to share that information with other people that may have an interest in listening to our shows but don't possibly know how to do it. And we appreciate your helping to get the word out when you do that. It is a holiday season, and we do have a store for Space Show items, T-shirts, hats, coffee mugs, license plate frames, and other interesting things, including clothing for little kids and babies, as well as for small to medium-sized dogs. So you can see that in that upper left menu under support. And there you will see the Cafe Press store. So do check it out. Your feedback is always welcome. On the center right is the most important information on the website as far as I'm concerned, because it is Support the Space Show information. So remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, GiantLeapFoundation.org, and we bring you these shows because many of you do financially support us. We're getting ready to start our annual campaign, which comes about around Thanksgiving time, but do remember, and I really mean it, that without those of you who support us, there simply would not be a space show. So if you appreciate the content, you like the shows, the guests, the ability to communicate back with us, help us along the way to do it. And remember, as a 501c3, if you're paying federal U.S. taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you're a California taxpayer, you also get a deduction, as we're a public benefit corp in the state of California. Visit our parent, onegiantleapfoundation.org. And if you have any questions, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then before I go into the rest of the announcements on the webpage, we do corporate sponsors as well as the individual sponsors. And so corporate sponsors are opening up now for 2018. And if you do want to do that, not only do you get a banner ad running across the homepage, as you see right now, but you also get a short message read on each and every Space Show program. And so that opportunity is available if you're interested. It is Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And we appreciate your interest in that program. And we certainly appreciate the sponsors that we have right now sponsoring the program and helping to keep the Space Show going on the airs. So remember that you can download all of our shows freely without a problem, but they are copyrighted, and there are a couple of rules about doing that. So one is that you should not edit or cut or clip or do anything like that with any of the programs and put them up on YouTube or any other website, including your own. Another one is don't do any business with any of our Space Show programs. And then finally, don't do any written transcripts. They're not permitted for our shows. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we certainly appreciate your doing that. We do have corporate sponsors for the first part of today's program. And the New Worlds Conference in Austin, Texas, man, it is just around the corner. November 10th through the 11th in Austin. It's part of the Austin Fair, I believe, and their website, newworlds2017.space. Remember, if you attend, I want you to get back to us and tell us what it was like, and if you thought it was a good conference. And then the Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor. This is a detailed 100-year forecast for our future in space. And it depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. You can find all about it at thespaceplan.com. And the online version expands into 500-plus elements for a lot more information. The online is a full-size plan. This is the one you would order, excuse me. So this is on their website, but you can actually buy it and order it, and they send it to you. It's a full-size color plan of the Integrated Space Plan. Very high quality, great for putting on your wall or your office door. Very inspirational. Every time you see it, you'll think about space development. And you can do that. And then they also have an Integrated Space Plan for children. And you may want to get the children's Integrated Space Plan to help your little ones along the way into being great participants in the space industry. So one more quick announcement, and that is that Friday is Veterans Day, which is a holiday in the United States, and there will be no show on Friday of this week. But we do resume on Sunday with our regular programming, and we have programming today, tomorrow, with Greg Autry, who was the head of the Trump landing team when he got elected and set up his space program. Greg is with us. And then we have Hotel Mars, and then no show on Friday. So Dr. Doug Plata is with us today as our guest. So those of you who listen to many Space Show programs and post on the blog, you know Doug very well. He's a medical doctor in Southern California. He has lunar cots. He developed that idea all on its own. It's very famous. It's gone viral. And you should check it out at the Lunar Cots website. And he has a new website he is working on that he will tell us about. And he's doing some pretty good, cool things with his lunar ideas and lunar hardware ideas and HAB ideas. And we're going to hear about all of it today. And his website is spacedevelopment.org. But Doug will tell us some things about that site. So everybody, I introduce to you Dr. Doug Plata. Doug, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, David. It's good to be back.
Always a pleasure, although you were here yesterday with us. So you're only gone for a short while. So what's new now? I mean, there's a lot of things that are new, I know. So get us started.
Yeah, so really, I think for my space advocacy activity, I think I'm coming to a real transition point for myself, and that is up until now I've been really trying to work, ultimately trying to achieve a policy of returning to the moon using really cost-effective approaches, in particular for the financing side of things, lunar COTS or public-private programs for return to the moon, and then in terms of the hardware, really trying to point to the Falcon Heavy as a way that America could get started to return to the moon in a very, very cost-effective sort of way, plus also cost-effective lunar lander, the modification of the Centaur upper stage as a lunar lander, otherwise known as the Zeus. That's United Launch Alliance and Mastin's concept. So it's sort of coming to a head right now with presumably the near-term launch of the Falcon Heavy. And so I'm working to complete this phase of my space advocacy work by trying to make the case that the Falcon Heavy should be America's initial moon rocket the Saturn V was our first one, but going forward, that we should start with the Falcon Heavy. And to make that case, I've constructed a full-size mock-up of the lunar lander stack, the size to fit on the Falcon Heavy. Of course, it's only a mock-up, and it would be displayed near Cape Canaveral. And then after the moment that event is done and the media is alerted and I seek to make the case for the Falcon Heavy being a lunar rocket, then I'm planning on transitioning to focusing on habitation systems, in particular conducting a Kickstarter campaign to develop out of vinyl a full-scale Unihab to be located near or by Tucson, Arizona. And then I'm also to help increase sort of raise the scale for the design, both of the habitat as well as the general concept for space development. I'm just now starting the Space Development Network, which I'll explain more. So that's sort of where I'm at.
Do you have time to be a doctor anymore?
Yes, I do. Fortunately, my work is very compatible with I have free time to be able to work on this stuff.
All right, so let's go step by step, okay, because you rattled off an awful lot of stuff. So there is a lot of talk today, but so far, as far as I know, no firm policy, but it looks like the Trump administration, the National Space Council, and others are getting very, very serious about actually returning as a national policy to going to the moon. So now where do you fit into the fact that we may actually have a policy for a change to go back to the moon?
So certainly, of course, I'm very pleased that we are talking, we meaning the country and the administration and Congress for that matter, and even NASA is talking about returning to the moon. So I think that is a success. I don't think I can claim any credit for that, but it is in line with what I would like to see. In terms of lunar costs, the public-private programs, that is possible. It's not official, but people are talking about public-private programs returning to the moon, and so my work will continue to say, well, let's do public-private programs, not just on a small scale, not just small landers to deliver sort of care packages, sort of science packages to the lunar surface, but really let's have a full-scale set of public-private programs, just like we did with COTS, commercial cargo, and commercial crew, but this time for commercial cargo and crew to the lunar surface. So that's a ongoing case I'm still seeking to make. I still have work to be done until we get clarity as to how we're going to return to the moon. And I count it as a good thing right now that we don't have real specificity as to how we're going to go to the moon, because that still provides myself and others with opportunity to make the case that we should develop a cost-effective transportation system to the moon. And in my opinion, that would not be using the SLS and a deep space gateway to go very expensively halfway to the moon. Instead, I think we should use commercial launchers to go all the way to the moon.
So your position is not even to do the deep space gateway. Am I correct?
I'm generally negative towards the Deep Space Gateway because it sure sounds like a prescription written for us to get bogged down, spending a whole lot of money getting bogged down in now low lunar orbit, when in fact where we want to go is actually to the lunar surface. And by we, I'm talking about international countries, and I think the Trump and you know, Pence administration, they say that they want to establish a permanent presence on the moon with crew. And if we spend billions or even tens of billions of dollars supporting a station that doesn't take the surface to the moon, I am concerned that we're going to end up making a small step towards the moon, but not really all the way there. And then the argument that we need a deep space gateway in order to support international and commercial landers to the moon is, I think, I am not convinced at all that that's the best way to spend our money. And I'm not even convinced that that would even be helpful to have a deep space gateway. I think we should just launch directly to the moon and then, and yes, rendezvous in cislunar space and hand off cargo and crew modules. But I don't actually see a need for the deep space gateway.
You want to use Falcon Heavy as a more cost-effective thing. Have you seen any information coming out of SpaceX where they want to see their rocket take on that role?
Well, certainly they have mentioned about using the Falcon Heavy to send crew to lunar orbit or lunar, at least a lunar flyby, if not lunar orbit. And as I look at the capabilities of Falcon Heavy, in fact, it's capable of doing that. The problem is as we all know, SpaceX, Elon Musk, and practically everybody in SpaceX is really, really focused on Mars. And so I don't think that they've really given a great deal of consideration as to how the Falcon Heavy could be used as a very cost-effective launcher for a lunar program. I personally think that this should be coming from the administration. I think the administration should be taking lead, and I'm quite confident that if a plan were to be developed to initially use the Falcon Heavy, do a block buy of 10, for example, 10 Falcon Heavies and 10 options, purchase 10 additional, then I think that SpaceX would be highly likely to say, well, sure, if you want to, you know, pay us for Falcon Heavy flights, we'd be glad to provide you as many as you require. But I think that will probably come more from the administration than from SpaceX.
Lots of things happening to unfold here. Do you have any? I mean, what you really are wanting to do is to bounce out this big government rocket with taxpayer dollars flowing into the fountain of youth there, you know, to the tune of billions and billions of dollars, and say, don't use that. Use this one over here by SpaceX. And
no.
Am I misunderstanding you?
Yeah, but I haven't really clarified it. I've mentioned it before, my position on SLS before on the space show, but just in the context here, I make a distinction between what launcher is necessary for the moon and what launcher is necessary for Mars. I do not believe we need a 130 metric ton vehicle for the moon. And in the Block 1 configuration like 70, well, that's essentially Falcon Heavy in terms of capability to LEO. And then if the lander was hydrolocked, then it could be able to deliver the same thing that the Block 1 SLS could deliver to the moon at a small fraction of the cost. So my argument is Falcon Heavy-based architecture for the moon initially until things like Vulcan and New Glenn come online, in which we can have some competition. But for Mars, I do believe we not only need a 130 metric ton vehicle, but we're going to need multiple launches per each crewed mission. And until the BFR becomes significant level of reality, then I support continuing with SLS, not for the moon, but for a Mars program.
in the same breath, I ask you, how do you dislodge the thinking on the deep space gateway, especially with Lockheed involved in this? They probably see this as a big profit center for them. How do you, and by the way, a lot of space show listeners think this is a useless project and are not at all happy with it. How do you plan to get them to go lunar surface rather than deep space gateway?
Well, my argument would be the deep space gateway can have arguably two functions. One is to support going to the moon, which is something I don't think that we need. Constellation never envisioned the need for deep space gateway as an example. However, the deep space gateway is sort of called that because the idea is, well, it could become a little mini ISS research station to be able to find out how can we do the long duration deep space missions to Mars. And I do see legitimacy and value in that. It's just that I would rather, instead of are doing that hardware for a station that's not necessarily going anywhere, instead I think that we should look at what would it take to do the initial steps to Mars, with the initial step being a Mars flyby. And do we really need a deep space gateway in order to do that, or can we actually start to construct the vehicles? I'm sort of thinking of the Lockheed Martin concept. Can we start developing those vehicles that will take us to Mars rather than spend money doing an interim step of a station that may or may not play a direct role in going to Mars but would be doing some research? Well, I think maybe we should do the research using vehicles that will actually go to Mars. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I sort of think the Deep Space Gateway is kind of a half-ass, lack of full commitment kind of program that's not necessary.
And the thing is, we need to start with looking at the first step, not the final step. And the first step is a Mars flyby. And I personally believe, as I look at the human factors data and the reliability of equipment data, I think that we could do that mission sooner than later. Like maybe we could do it in, you know, within 10 years, I would think, or less. And so I think I would like for NASA to be tasked of saying, okay, set your focus first on a flyby and tell us what do you need in order to do that, and then fund that. So I'm in a bit of a rush both to the moon and to Mars. I feel like we're going slower than what we ought to be.
Well, that's an interesting question. So how do you speed up that timeline? There's a lot of pressures on people within the government, as you know.
Yeah, well, mind you, the Trump administration actually has publicly stated that they would like to send people to the moon and to Mars in an earlier timeline than what we had been on before. Isn't that correct?
I've certainly heard that about the moon. I don't recall hearing it about Mars, but it wouldn't surprise me.
So when Trump spoke to the astronauts in the ISS, this is like, you know, I don't know, 8 months ago or something like this, quite a while back, he made mention about wanting to send people to Mars within his administration, if I'm not mistaken.
Did he say he was going to send them on the ISS to Mars? Please tell me no.
No. He didn't specify how. And, of course, a lot of us are like, excuse me, sending people to Mars within your administration? Well, to me, if going to Mars means doing the first step, the Mars flyby, that would still be pushing it. But if we were to look at doing a 590-day mission with enough safety from a radiation, microgravity, and equipment reliability standpoint, it might be doable, but we had better get going. And I'm concerned we've lost about a year of an administration, and we're still not got the plans clear.
Given that Falcon Heavy has not flown yet, is this the right time to be making your case that Falcon Heavy should be the moon rocket?
Well, that's a great question. Specifically, what I would argue is that the administration should not come out with a specific plan until Falcon Heavy at least does their first attempt. Because if they specify a plan and then a couple months later or less, Falcon Heavy succeeds, then the question is did the plan take into account the availability of that piece of hardware at that time? And what I'd say, there's enough value that the Falcon Heavy could add to almost any architecture just because of its cost effectiveness and its pretty high capability to LEO, that we shouldn't exclude that from our plans. But what I would totally say is that, you know, Elon Musk has made statements about the initial launch of the Falcon Heavy where he's expressing lack of certainty as to whether it will succeed. It could blow up. He has described the risk that it might take out the pad, and that would be a setback in terms of the timeline. So we need to be realistic here and recognize that it has not flown yet, and it may take a number of launches, two or three, something like that, before they get it working. And what I'd say is I'm perfectly fine with the administration, Congress, and NASA, the combined plan, saying we are not going to commit to a block buy of Falcon Heavies until it has demonstrated a successful first flight. I would be fine with that.
Your first listener question comes from John in Baltimore, of course, by email. What else? Listener, the phone line is again 1-866-687-7221. And he says, Doug, on several previous Space Show programs, including call-ins, when you've called to other guests or on open lines, you have talked about displaying your habitat for the moon at the time of the Falcon Heavy launch. Are you still planning to do that? And how hard is it to do that when the dates for the Falcon Heavy launch are tenuous at best and may suffer big delays, and you're down there ready to go, but the rocket's not ready to go?
Oh, that is a great question, isn't it?
Yeah, and that he should have called us, but that's okay.
Sure, sure. I've thought about that, and frankly, he nails it on the head. We have December 29 as a NET, no earlier than launch day. So SpaceX might be pretty motivated to try to launch it within this calendar year just so they can stop, you know, how many years it's been delayed, if you know what I mean. Nonetheless, realistically, it could easily go ahead and push into 2018. So basically my strategy is I'm not going to get time off work, and I'm not going to purchase the ticket until a real date has been set. And my plane ticket is going to be I can pay a little bit more so I can reschedule it if need to be, if they shift it. I'll go ahead and ship the large-scale inflatable lander that I've created. I'll go ahead and ship it and have it in storage down there so that can be ready to go at any time. I'm going to have to work with either Port Canaveral or Space Florida, whoever I can work with, to go ahead and get the location, display it, and working with space advocates down there to sort of get the word out about it. I will have to, you know, be honest with them and say, hey, I don't know exactly when it's going to launch, but these are the best dates that we have now, and just sort of tentatively play it by ear. And then what I'd like to do is schedule my time off work so that I arrive right close to when it's supposed to launch. But if there's weather delays, then I'll have a few days afterwards that I don't have to be back at work. And I can afford to hang around if it's been delayed because of a stuck valve or weather or whatever.
So you're going to be there for New Year's?
I could be. I mean,
oh my God.
Frankly, David, this is the focus of my space advocacy work right now. To make all of my effort worthwhile, I need to, you know, need to be willing to do whatever it takes to make this happen.
So if you're there over New Year's, you might sort of mosey, as we'd say in Oklahoma, over to Port Canaveral and see if you can get on one of those gambling cruisers that goes out into the ocean and party so that you have something to do on New Year's Eve.
Well, I don't gamble, and I'm not quite sure. I frankly haven't thought about the New Year's or what would...
Well, otherwise you'll just be, you know, in your hotel watching TV or reading a book or something.
Well, there's some people I know in Orlando and Titusville, so I think probably I would ask them, hey, what are you guys doing? And can I join you guys? So.
Well, I'm just kidding around with you. Do you know yet, I mean, if people are interested like John in Baltimore that will be in the area or that live in the area, do you actually know the location of your display so people can see it? And then my question would be, will it be available for people to see both before and after the launch, and for how long before and how long? Are you talking about an hour before and then you have to tear it down right away after the launch, or will it be there for a couple of days before and after?
So what I would do is I'm sorry, there was two questions there, was there?
Well, yeah, basically, do you have a site secured yet where you're going to have the display? And then how much time do people have if they want to come down and see it? Do they have to see it right away or what?
Yeah. So in terms of the location, I have been in contact with Port Canaveral. I certainly have not gained any commitment there. But what I wanted to do was to be able to have a photograph of the actual mock-up, which I now have because I've finished the mock-up. But I also would sort of like to be able to have a specific date so that they can look at their schedule and see what, you know, the use of their place is going to be. I think that I probably am going to need to contact them without a specific date, which would add some uncertainty to the discussion. But that's my next plan. And in terms of, I don't know what time of day the Falcon Heavy is going to launch. I'm guessing it's going to be during daylight because it's not going to have a payload, right?
Right.
I mean, it's not going to have a, you know, like a satellite payload. It's going to have a silly payload. You know, just something to demonstrate. But, so presume it's going to be during the daylight, and so I would probably have the mock-up set up at least first thing in the morning, maybe the night before, but it's got to be able to sustain winds of whatever the winds are going to be at that time. So I don't know that I want it to be inflated overnight. Probably it would not be inflated, be secured on the ground. So at least from the morning until the launch, and then it would be for the rest of the day, or if it's launched in early morning or a late day, then I'd probably have it set up the day before and or the day after. And if anybody has ideas about how I can get the word out about this, because that's the whole thing. There's no, as far as I know, in Cape Canaveral area, there's no central spot where everybody gathers to watch a launch, you know, the public, that is. Journalists have their place. And so if anybody has some ideas about how I could really attract attention to it, I would most appreciate that.
Okay, so listeners, especially, well, you don't have to be in the Orlando or Cape area. If you have ways or ideas to get the word out once Doug's plans finalize and crystallize, get a hold of him and let him know. Does that new website that we talked about early in the show have a way for them to contact you?
Yes. At the bottom, it has my new email address for the Space Development Network, so they can contact me that way.
Okay. So, listeners, if you do have ideas, if you publish a newsletter or you have a blog or you have a way of helping to get the word out, then contact Doug and work that out directly with him. I know the lay of the land, so Port Canaveral is not necessarily something you're going to drive by on your way out to see the launch.
Right.
So, and then a lot of people who can't get on to Cape Canaveral Air Force Base park by the side of the road in Titusville and other places, you know, to see the launches. So you're going to have to let them know that it's there. I understand why you want to get additional promotion. Obviously, you can tell the space show, and we will be telling people on every show that it's there and go huff and puff and see it. So,
you know, I'm If it's legal, I'm thinking about putting out little signs on the roadsides around the area, advertising the mock-up and a web address where people can go to and see the map and see pictures, whatnot, and then they can see exactly where to go.
So what is the material? Can you write like your name? Can you sign your name on the material
that the mock-up is made out of?
Yeah.
It's 6mm sheet plastic. You just get it at Home Depot.
I was going to suggest if it were something heavier, you could say, go see it and autograph it. You know, it'd be a little catch for people to come over and see it because they want to sign it. But probably they'd tear it apart if they were trying to write on 6mm.
My experience when I displayed it in the gymnasium for the high school that I was using their gymnasium, when the young kids came up to the full size thing, all they wanted to do was get inside the thing. that was like their top priority, and I didn't design it to go inside. You know,
so they can't. So that's another question. It's not something you can go inside of.
Well, it wasn't intended to, but because there's such an interest in going inside, I mean, it's not like it's the inside of a, how can I say, it's not like the cabin of a spacecraft, you know, it's just the tank, you know, but since people so much want to go inside, I think if it's safe to do so, I think I'll create some sort of airlock or something like that, that people can be able to go inside it while still it being inflated.
You have pictures of this on a website, right?
I don't actually. I will go ahead and put it up on the blog.
I thought I saw pictures of your inflatable structure before that you posted on the blog or something.
I did post it on the blog, and I'll go ahead and do that again. I'll show you the listeners. I'll show both the diagram as well as the actual photograph in the gymnasium.
Do you have music playing like Rocket Man or something like that when you get up to it? You know, you got to have the drama and the flair with it, Doug. You got
to. I'm writing that down, David. That's a great idea.
You know, I'm not saying you want to have Rocket Man. They may think they've gone to North Korea or something, but but you can figure out something. But give them something more than just the thing to go see. You want to really lure them over there. So. I think it'd be really cool.
I'm sort of wondering whether we should have a countdown clock, you know, and sort of keep that synchronized to the actual clock. Who knows what else we could have?
Well, yeah, that's just a big digital clock. You could probably get one, you know, fairly inexpensively from someplace down there, an event clock or something like that.
If somebody has a spacesuit that we could borrow, I think that, you know, people like astronauts.
Well, maybe a costume shop has one. I'll bet Orlando costume shops in the area, probably space paraphernalia and space clothes, are pretty common costumes, I would think.
If anybody has a doggy spacesuit, oh, that would be big.
a dog, but who's the dog you're going to get for it?
We'd find a dog. That's not a problem. Get into the spacesuit.
There's been a couple of dogs early on that went into space, and I'm not sure how many people know about that. So, depending on when they were born and whether they went to school in this country or some other country.
I don't care. You put any dog in a spacesuit and it's going to be a winner, especially with the kids. I have little doubt about that.
Well, you'll have to have somebody down there doing pictures and stuff. And put the kids in the spacesuit, damn it. Don't have somebody else. And that's what you want to do. You want to have the kids wear the spacesuit and then get pictures made. Or they can take their own picture. That's something like that. Have the kids become the astronaut.
I'm taking notes, David.
That's right. Courtesy of the space show. Turn it into, and you can sell space dogs there instead of hot dogs. You can have a space dog stand.
Oh, that's funny.
Well, we're gonna look forward to news about this toward the end of the year, and I do have I don't know that I have a real end of the year show planned, but I do notice that December 31st is a Sunday, and so the Sunday space show program would be noon, and my friends that I normally do things with on New Year's Eve are going to be in New York, and I'm not going to be there. So I'm thinking if I haven't torn the studio down yet for my move, I may do a December 31st space show program. I'm leaving that open. But it'd be great if we could, see what you're doing and have pictures of it and talk about it.
If it launches on 29th of December, and there is a modest chance that it will, because they might want to do it within this calendar year, I think that would be like striking the iron while it's hot, having a show on the 31st and, describing the launch.
What's the date of the what day of the week is the 29th? Friday. So I may have a Friday show already set up. If I'm not tearing the studio down for moving, I think Tom Olson does his end of the year show again this year, and I believe that is going to be on Friday the 31st. Let me look it up if my Windows machine will cooperate with me.
Yeah, 31st is a Sunday.
Yeah, no, I know that. I looked it up to see if there was a possible way to do an end of the year show. But let me see who's going to be the guest and what's the last day of the year. Tom Olson is doing the end of the year review Friday morning, December 29th.
Elon said that whether it succeeds or blows up, it's guaranteed to be an exciting launch. And I agree.
Well, you don't want to see it blow up, although rocket blow-ups are pretty cool, but... I don't want to. But anyway, that's my schedule. So if the studio has not been torn down for moving, I am really I don't know who listens to the space show on the end of the year on December 31st, but it is at noon. So I suspect people are still probably sober and around the house, that they haven't gone out partying yet or anything like that. So we might do some kind of a thing. It's too bad we can't stream you live from there, but I don't know how to do that.
Doing a live show, that'd be amazing.
Well, you'd need to broadcast from there, and it's not just having your phone doing it. So anyway, we can talk about it later. What else have you got planned around this Falcon Heavy launch, or is that it?
Well, let me clarify something, because nobody's brought up this issue, but it's a very relevant issue that I want to bring out, and that is a Falcon-based architecture. Okay, for very cost-effective architecture for return to the moon. Somebody ought to point out that, hey, wait a minute, isn't Falcon Heavy going to be phased out? Right.
Well, that's what it says, but we don't really know that.
Well, that's his stated intent, so we have to take that possibility, into account. And my argument is it doesn't really change anything, except that the government, NASA may not have an unlimited amount of time to get around to making the decision regarding block purchases of Falcon Heavy. That I believe that if whatever the number of launches that the government were to purchase, SpaceX would be totally happy to supply that, and so that would probably go ahead and extend their production line by however many modules or cores that would require. I just don't want a year and a half, 2 years to go by before this decision is made, in which case perhaps the production lines might be, starting to ramp down.
We can talk about how you intend to influence a national policy decision, because I think that's an interesting story on its own, how you, the space advocate, is going to work to shape that policy decision. But first I'm going to read you a question by Adrian in San Diego. I wonder what the impact of a Falcon Heavy failure and even a spectacular pad failure would mean for the habitat display publicity. Wouldn't it be better to wait for, say, the second successful Falcon Heavy launch and then really push the future possibilities for the habitat idea? As far as the inflatable display, rather than a stationary display, since there is no central gathering spot to guarantee a significant number of viewers. How about driving it around to several viewing locations in some large truck or semi with whatever is needed for wind protection surrounding it and protecting it from the slipstream while moving it around? Good luck.
Thank you. First of all, it's not inflatable habitat, it's an inflatable lander. And to make a distinction, this mock-up of the lander is an inflatable lander, but I'm also talking about, we'll talk about this later in the show, about the Unihab, which is an inflatable habitat. And on the moon, the inflatable would not be a mock-up, it'd be a real thing. But in Tucson, it would be a simulated inflatable. So just a clarification there. I don't want to spend a whole lot of money, so I don't know about renting a big rig and doing that. I'm going to try to, especially if somebody knows really how to work social media. I think that can be very powerful to target. Like, I don't know, Google Ads that are targeting people within that area might be helpful. I don't know if getting a whole bunch of reaching out to high schools and middle schools might help. But I'm inclined to go with a static location and then try to find ways to get people to know about it and come to there. That's my current thinking.
So take an awful lot of PR to get people to come there.
Yeah, and I don't want to have put in this much work and then people kicking themselves saying, oh, if I only knew it was there, I would have shown up. I'd love to see that, you know.
Well, you're certainly going to need to get newspaper and local TV stations to publicize it and cover it. So
right.
You're going to have to do some local media groundwork.
In which case, if I already have it displayed the day before and to get TV exposure of it on that day, maybe that would be one of the most effective ways of getting the word out.
I'd kind of start working with them this far in advance and tell them what you're planning to do and where you think it'll be and who can you contact and how much time ahead of time do they need to know that it's up and running for them to come out and do a story. And I'd start laying the groundwork.
Now, mind you, my space advocacy work has primarily been attempting to reach the decision makers directly, you know, by doing, you know, lobbying and emailing and phone calls and all these sorts of things. A petition was targeted to them as well. But this is really sort of interesting, which I'm trying to sort of go to the general public to get to raise awareness generally in hopes that the decision makers will say, hey, everybody else is paying attention to this. Maybe we should too. So it's sort of a different approach for me.
Well, it's all a learning process, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah.
Well, one can only hope that the Falcon Heavy launches and it is a successful launch. So.
Oh, so I don't think I answered the question about what if it fails? Wouldn't it be better?
Oh, yeah. That was part of Adrian's email.
Yeah. My feeling is that if it succeeds, then I'm really going to kick myself that I didn't display it at that time, because there will be no event, no launch of the Falcon Heavy more broadly covered by the media than the initial launch. So I really think I need to have it at that point in time. If it blows up...
Just take it down real fast and get the hell out of it.
My argument would be, hey, rockets blow up, but, you know, look at Falcon 1. It blew up three times, right? And finally on the fourth time, it made it to orbit. So what I would say, my argument is, hey, this is rocket science. It's hard. Rockets blow up. But really the question is it going to fly eventually? And if it flies eventually, if it succeeds eventually, then we ought to look at the Falcon Heavy as being America's moon rocket initially. So really my message doesn't change, and I think for the sake of hitting the iron while it's hot, meaning when the Falcon Heavy launches, if it's successful, I will have wanted to be there, you know. If it's not successful, I will have still gotten my message out. It's just that there'll be more work to do to continue to make a case that, yeah, From a policy standpoint, it does make sense to commit ourselves to purchasing it now, but we should still consider that policy the moment that the Falcon Heavy demonstrates that it can reach orbit.
So what is your grand strategy to have your ideas become our policy?
So it really probably comes down to maybe Pence, if I could help him understand that there is a policy option which would accomplish far more than the current default plan to return to the moon. So I consider the default approach is SLS creating a deep space gateway and then looking to unfunded or small-funded commercial companies to develop landers, probably starting with a series of small landing missions, and then pushing off the full-scale lander, the Zeus-sized lander, off to somewhere in the future, having no particular policy about that, while also looking to our international partners and saying, hey, maybe you could develop a lunar lander, a full-scale lunar lander. To me, that is sort of what I'm viewing as the default way that is what will probably be the lunar return policy. So if you compare that approach in which it puts off humans to the moon sort of indefinitely, meaning in, you know, not really clear exactly when they would be going to the moon, compare that with the plan for sustainable space development, which I'm proposing. In which it's Falcon Heavy, it has this telerobotic phase, but a full-size lander so that we can move to human rating that lander to be able to deliver crew in a safe manner to the lunar surface, and then establishing initial large habitat on the moon that's shielded, has lunar greenhouse inside, as well as an indoor centrifuge for long-duration stays that... You know, would Mike Pence and Trump, would they like to be known as the administration that actually was the one that set the path and moved the ball forward to where it was basically inevitable to humanity establishing the first permanent off-Earth base? You know, between these two, what gives you bigger bang for your buck? And I think the plan for sustainable space development really blows away. I mean, if they want to make America great and accomplish great things in space, I think this plan works much better.
Don't you think that these invested professionals would tend to blow you off, so you'd have a lot of resistance to get through to Mike Pence or Scott Pace or some of the others?
Probably yes. And so I'm looking at strategies for doing an in-run around the gatekeepers. You know, is Scott Pace going to tell them their options, including the plan for sustainable space development and full-scale lunar COTS? I don't know. You know, certainly he supports SLS, and he hasn't really said anything about the Deep Space Gateway. How about the other people? How about the 45-day, you know, NASA recommendations? Are they really going to present all of the options, including a very cost-effective option to the administration? I'm thinking probably not. So I'm looking at other congressmen and other ways to try to get my message to them and to go to the National Space Council directly rather than through the current space advocacy organizations.
Can you attend a National Space Council meeting, or do you know how that's done?
No, the first one was invitation only, and I don't think I rise to that level of prominence. So I think I probably wouldn't be able to get in on those.
Let's leave the moon and your display for a moment, okay?
Sure.
And so let's talk about some of your other ideas and things. If we go to the surface of the moon, what is your idea of what the, I don't know, let's just call them astronauts, okay? What are they going to do? Are they going to have busy work? Are they going to just be assembling the habitat? What is their value and purpose for going there?
Okay. First, I'd just like to point out, if people go to spacedevelopment.org, it lays out the plan in very nicely organized detail. Unfortunately, I need to let them know if they go there immediately. I don't think that those that page. I'm working with somebody else to try to get my files on that website. But for the time being, like for the next 12 to 36 hours, probably, if people go to developspace.info, then they can see the whole plan laid out there. But really, spacedevelopment.org is the website that I'm transitioning to on a permanent basis. So having said that, just very briefly, it involves simultaneously a lunar prospecting mission, which is a planned NASA mission, that we do need to do that to be able to really characterize what is the nature of the ice at the poles. So we need to do that. We need to accelerate that. And it's looking pretty good after the league meeting in Baltimore. It seems as though probably that's going to be accelerated. So I would definitely support that. But at the same time, we need to start lunar COTS. And that means potentially block purchase of the Falcon Heavies so we get the initial launch capability squared away. But most importantly is the development of a full-scale lunar lander. And to me, we should open it up, competition. But frankly, I think ULA's Zeus concept is the right idea, and it's would be ahead of the game because it's based on an existing upper stage, the Centaur upper stage. And as part of that, I think a small amount of funding to Masten to do a terrestrial demonstration of their of the Centaur upper stages that they have in storage there in Mojave. For $20 million, we can see the full landing sequence with a full-size lander. Not ready to be launched. It's real hardware, but not ready. It's not in a shape to be launched. These are old stages. So that's that prospecting phase. I call that phase zero. But we are developing the full-size lander, and within probably a period of 4 to 5 years, something like that, we should be able to launch the telerobotic phase. And this is one-way missions of Falcon Heavy to LEO and then the Hydrolox lunar lander from LEO to the lunar surface. And that stack would be looking just like what's on display at Port Canaveral. It's that design. We'd be able to deliver 10 tons of hardware one-way to the lunar surface, to the lunar poles, to make an attempt at harvesting ice telerobotically to refuel the lander. And based upon the LCROSS data and other information, I believe that it's more likely than not that a sufficient amount of ice could be harvested to refuel the lander even before crew arrives. But nonetheless, even if that process for whatever reason doesn't work out, then we should still commit to going to the moon, meaning that whereas we're certainly trying to aim for the ice, it's not on the critical path. Meaning, if for whatever reason we can't harvest it successfully, we should then be launching two Falcon Heavies for each crewed mission. In other words, we can still continue with the program. It's just that we're not going to be able to reduce the price like we'd like to. It'd still be far more cost effective than the SLS and Deep Space Gateway. Then after the telerobotic phase, that's phase one. Then phase two is after you human rate the lander, then you launch crew up to an EML staging point, and the lander ascends from the moon after being refilled, docks with the crew module, and brings them down. And then you have the initial crewed phase. And prior to the crew arriving, the automated lander would land a large inflatable habitat and set it up, cover it with regolith, and get it ready for crew to arrive. But when the initial crew arrives, the purpose of the initial crew is to maintain and expand the telerobotic workforce. That's their job. And the purpose, it's a infrastructure job, fundamentally. It's a transportation job. And that is, it's to maintain the telerobots and to assemble more robots and even harvesting metals to produce the bulky materials, the wheels, the chassis, things like that, But the fine precision, the electronics, these things are being shipped by the cargo deliveries, cargo landers. Then you have that initial phase with just a few people in the habitat, and then that's phase two. Phase three, as I see it, is when you're getting the transportation system sort of running on a regular basis. That's where you have this very interesting phase of international lunar exploration. I think there is evidence that there is a great deal of interest in countries having their own national astronauts walking on the moon and exploring it on behalf of their citizens back in their country. So it would totally play on each country's national pride of watching their people walking on the moon, exploring the moon in their own language, again, on behalf of their people. And so that phase would provide the participating companies a great deal of business that is off the budget of NASA. So already these companies are transitioning off the NASA budget. And then with the increased flight rate and an increased telerobotic workforce producing more and more propellant, then that goes into the following stage, and that is, will transportation to the moon be low cost enough that individuals could be able to go to the moon for whatever reason they want to, whether that's tourism, whether that's going to stay and being part of the historic process of humanity beginning to move off Earth. So that's how I see what the jobs of these initial crew would be.
Ted is in San Diego with a question for you. And he says, do you really believe that the market is going to exist to do this up front, or are you thinking the government or somebody with pretty deep pockets is going to have to make this project stay alive until the markets are there?
Okay, so to answer that question, let me just go with the current public-private programs, COTS, commercial cargo, commercial crew. Was there a market for COTS? Well, yes, because the government made that market. The government was the customer, okay? So the companies are certainly earning a lot of money. They certainly earned a lot of money with COTS to develop that capability. So in a sense, it's not a commercial market, but it's a government market. And for the participating companies, I don't think they really care where the money comes from, just so long as they get the money. So I would say for that phase, for lunar COTS, yes, I think if we choose to do that and fund it at 5-7% of NASA's budget, just like we've done before, then the same thing that happened before will happen again. So I think the answer is yes. In terms of the next phase, the international exploration phase, I don't know that anybody has really surveyed countries to find out if there is a demand on the part of various international countries to see their national astronauts exploring the moon on behalf of their citizens. But we do have some evidence amongst the ISS partners that they would like to go to the moon. I mean, practically everybody but the United States wants to go to the moon. I mean, that was during the Obama administration. Now even the United States wants to go to the moon. So with the evidence from just the ISS partners, I think the answer is yes, there is a demand there for those services. And then are they representative of other countries of the world? I don't have any hard data, but I have the feeling that if it works good for the ISS partners, it probably holds true for other countries as well, that they would like to see their astronauts on the moon. Then the ultimate question is, okay, after the governments have deep pockets. I mean, even small governments do. After that, and it gets to where we have a high flight rate, lower cost, and by then maybe actually New Glenn might be in the running, might be available by that point in time. Would there be enough of an interest on the part of private individuals, a truly commercial market? And I would say at this point, I don't know that we have enough information to be able to say yay or nay. But I would say the lower you bring the cost and the price, then the easier it is, the more that the market grows. And it's not a linear relationship. It's sort of a somewhat exponential or really a sigmoid shape relationship. To where if you get the price down to some critical point, which we don't really know where that is, then there would likely be enough of a market demand for these services.
You have a caller.
Okay.
Good afternoon, caller. Who are you and where are you? And thank you for calling the show.
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Good afternoon, Kim.
Hey, Kim.
Hey, Doug. There are these... My concerns when I listen about your plan circle around one issue, really. Charles Miller and his team have a plan. Dennis Wingle and his team, they have a plan. Those guys have been in the game for a long time, and they're engineers, and their team is full of engineers. And I know you do a lot of research, but when you talk about approaching the administration and you talk about making real policy changes to plans for things that are actually going to be launched, it always comes back to me that you need a way of vetting your plan so that you have someone saying this is a viable plan signed me a recognized aerospace engineer. How you feel about that? If you've considered that approach, or how you get around that?
Well, so several things. Number one is a lot of my ideas I borrow from other people who are professionals. Like, say, for example, the full-size lunar lander, the Zeus, that is something which there's published papers. I mean, ULA is obviously a company with engineers and Bernard Cutter, the company there. Zegler, I think, has produced a lot of work in regards to the lander. So I don't feel, at least in terms of lander, I don't feel as though I don't really need to buttress that because the papers are already out there on that. In terms of the capability of the Falcon Heavy, we are sort of dependent upon SpaceX and all of their engineers to be telling the truth in regards to a fully expendable Falcon Heavy and what that is capable of. And so I don't know that they've really published papers showing how they get to those numbers, but they are advertising, and they would sell to people based upon those numbers. What I would say is in terms of integrating the plan where you have these different elements which are well supported by studies or the market, then what happens is, yes, a plan integrates these things together. And what I would say is that I do not, I'm not an aerospace engineer, and I don't have a team as such. I did seek to work with a well-published aerospace engineer to actually do an AIAA paper that would lay out this full plan, and at least, we would have him with his, well-recognized experience. Now, I spoke with him on the phone, a number of phone conversations. He did like the plan. He felt it was feasible, but it was, in terms of actually working with him by phone to actually get that paper done, it wasn't happening. It was just hard to make progress over the phone. I'm not going to go into details exactly what the challenge was, but it just was not, it just didn't work out with him. So, I think it would be great, but I think at this point in time there is too little time left in order to do that before the Falcon Heavy launches. What I would say is what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get somebody in the administration to say, hey, if this plan for sustainable space development, if they're arguing that all of these outcomes, these incredible outcomes, are achievable at relatively low cost, and they're pointing to our public-private programs and experience or timeline and budgets for those, as well as Falcon Heavy, the data we have on that, and the Zeus lander. If for that matter, the Bigelow modules could be used as evidence in support of a surface inflatable habitat. If the argument is that all of these incredible accomplishments achieved through this cost-effective plan, then is this plan, is it really workable? And if they have that question, if they want to know, is this workable, then they could turn to their experts, especially at NASA, to say, go ahead and look at this plan and say, how feasible is it? Can the Falcon Heavy do that? Can the Zeus do that? You know, how about the budgetary side of things? And have them weigh in and do a decent evaluation of this plan. And if the plan needs to be tweaked a little bit, I'm totally open to that.
Let me interject something. How do you get it to the point in the context of Kim's question so that NASA would even be willing to put the time and the investment and the attention into some sort of feasibility approach of what you're presenting? Because keep in mind, they have their own people giving them information who have planned and directed, you know, missions that have been very successful before and stuff like that. I mean, what is your kicker, or what do you do to get them to at least send it in for review?
So NASA serves at the pleasure of the president or the administration, you know.
Theoretically, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, certainly they have their own ideas, but you bet NASA serves at the pleasure of the president. I mean, they really do support whoever the president is. If the president says Mars only, guess what? They're suddenly a Mars only organization. If they say we want to return to the moon, suddenly they have all sorts of ideas about returning to the moon. So I really think trying to reach those people that we're talking about, especially Pence, if Pence could understand what the true options are, and I'm concerned that he's not being given all of the options. So to me, it really comes down to, can we get to somebody who has the ear of Pence and say, hey, you have the standard approaches that are being delivered to you, but there is this other approach that does claim a very cost-effective and high-achieving plan. And might you want NASA to look into that? If from the administration they say, hey, could you do a quick feasibility study on this other plan, that's all that I could ask for. And I feel pretty confident that the Falcon Heavy numbers are going to fall, the lunar cost numbers are going to bear, because that's based on recent history. I think the Falcon Heavy numbers are going to hold up. I think the Zeus numbers are going to hold up. The inflatable is a solvable issue. I think that it's going to stand up to scrutiny.
So,
could I say something?
Yeah, it's your call.
Yeah.
First of all, I noticed that there was another sound of a phone ringing, and maybe I should clear the line.
No. That was my cell phone from my vet. So that's just, I didn't have it silenced. Normally, you wouldn't have heard that. So my fault.
Okay.
As the new generation says, my bad. My bad, everybody. Oh, Jesus. Go ahead.
So I was just going to say, based on what you say, Doug, then again, it comes back to the Space Council. The people on that council still are, they're industry people, they're academic people. One way or another, somebody who's big in one of those two communities has to back you. I just can't see another way that you'd get any more traction than you have right now.
So I think that you have to understand the Space Council is actually coordinating the different agencies of the government. And so, frankly, I don't know that the Department of Defense, for example, really has any interest in the civilian space program. So I'm not sure that the individual members of the Space Council are the key players. In other words, who amongst the Space Council is really going to propose the plan for returning to the moon? Well, I really think it's NASA, probably. And NASA's probably going to give the standard sort of approach, is what I'm thinking. And the 45 days is running out. So really what I need to do is I think I need to go ahead and try to approach, try to figure out who, you know, this is the question that was with us throughout the Obama administration, is who is actually making decisions in terms of whether we do an asteroid or whether, you know, how we go to Mars, all of these sorts of things. Is it Lori Garver? Is it Bolden? You know, who exactly was it really the one making those decisions? And at this point in time, I don't really know exactly who is making those decisions. But, you know, would Bridenstine have a significant say in terms of the design of the Return to the Moon program? I can reach through him. I have email contact, and I've met with his space staffer. That might be an approach. Might it be through Gingrich? Might it be through Walker, Representative Walker? You know, what are the different ways? And I don't know for sure, but I want to try all of those ways.
So, Doug, I don't remember this, so I'm asking you this sincerely. Do you remember when we first met around the space show? And I have a reason for asking this.
Well, we first met physically at New Space 2012.
Okay, and when did you start calling the space show and sort of get known to where we talked with one another? And you were more than just a here and there casual caller.
Well, I started calling probably about April or May of 2012.
Okay.
So a couple months before the conference.
I want to go back in history further than that.
Okay.
Because something you said triggered this. So, and I'm not trying to be Debbie Downer here. I'll leave that for Michael Listener to be Debbie Downer on the space show. Because I believe that strange things can happen and people can do an awful lot with capability and will and commitment. Mike Griffin, during the Bush administration, came up with the Constellation plan to go back to the moon. And a lot of people, including real aerospace engineers, thought it sucked for a variety of reasons. And a group of people, and I first met them at an AIAA meeting, I think in San Jose, that's how far back this goes. And their program was initially called DIRECT, which you may know about historically. And they designed what they believed to be a more efficient, more powerful, cheaper, and better set of rockets than what Constellation was using, Ares 1 and Ares, what was it, 5 or something like that. And they really promoted among engineers and people, even at NASA, when Mike Griffin was the administrator, this concept of DIRECT, and it evolved into DIRECT 1.0, and I think the final version was like DIRECT 2.2 or something like that. And I did lots and lots of shows with these guys because mm-hmm. it was really interesting. And in the end, and they would make statements like you made, Mike Griffin's not seeing all the options. This is Mike Griffin's baby, but he needs to see all the options, and this is a better option than Project Constellation. And, you know, on and on and on. And we've got a better approach, and this is how it's going to work. And the controls that went into NASA, because as much as I'm a really good friend with Mike and I like him very much, by the way, I think the new position that he's being considered for is a perfect position for him. But that's an aside. He had kind of many little rebellions going on in NASA. And a lot of it was around the authoritarian style of Project Constellation and stuff like that. There were other reasons, too. But people were trying to get NASA and the government and other key people, and there was a huge following for Project DIRECT. I mean, it wasn't just one person like you.
David?
Yeah.
David, could I just jump to what I think your question is, and that is, if DIRECT, with all of their engineering talent, was not able to get...
Didn't get squat.
The Constellation.
Yeah, didn't get to squat. Yeah, that's exactly right. So,
okay.
And they had muscle behind it.
Yeah.
Serious muscle behind it. Yeah.
Yeah, let me answer your question. Please understand, I have never claimed that I'm confident that anybody's, you know, that this is going to become the national space policy. I am a peon. I am nobody, like most of us.
I don't believe that for a minute, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, I'm not an idiot.
I know you're not in the community, per se. I agree, but you're not
policy,
you're not a peon.
You know, they're not going to turn to me of their own initiative to say, Doug, what do you think we should do? They're not going to do that. So as a space advocate, how do we operationalize our ideas? How do we go from our ideas to actually making it actually happen? Especially for me, I know it's not as much for Kim, but to affect space policy. You know, how is that done? And frankly, that has been the question that, you know, has been the big question for me throughout my space advocacy career. How do you go from ideas to making it happen?
And I don't, by the way, know the answer to that either, by the way.
It's not an easy thing. And I'll be perfectly honest, and I've said this before, I think that the odds of my being successful is pretty low because I'm a nobody. I'm not a billionaire. I'm not an Elon Musk. Nobody retweets my tweets, you know? So how can I, with such little authority, how can I leverage what little I have to possibly make enough of an impact to actually change space policy? That's the fundamental question here as a space advocate.
Right, and I was using DIRECT as an example of what happened
sure.
when they did have muscle behind it.
Yeah, and so I'm looking for creative ways. I've always been looking for creative ways of how can I pop my head above the noise and hopefully get attention. And this whole bit about doing something that's a bit crazy, having a balloon, a full-scale blow-up of a full-scale lander at the launch of the Falcon Heavy, well, I'm trying to figure out what is going to get the attention of the media. And I think a great visual of this full-size lander at the launch of the Falcon Heavy is the thing that I'm thinking of right now that might get me above the noise, you know? But I want to try other ways. You know, I've done personal lobbying in D.C.
I know.
Trying to reach into those people who are on those space subcommittees, you know. But what the other thing that I want to do, which is different than DIRECT, I think, and that is DIRECT was somewhat less expensive than the very expensive program. It is somewhat more accomplishments than the Constellation program. I'm arguing that if, from a political standpoint, if Trump wants to go down in history, he has choices. He can go the standard route, in which, realistically, what would he end up with? Making progress, maybe actually achieving a deep space gateway, but will American footprints be actually on the moon? And if so, is it going to be so expensive that it's going to be difficult to sustain? Okay, I think that is the standard way that we're moving. And then contrast that with what I'm proposing. Lunar COTS, way more cost-effective, using numbers that we're quite familiar with based on the current public-private programs, and then actually being able to look at choosing the very people during this administration who are going to be the crew that will go to the moon in a sustained sort of way, meaning This is Christopher Columbus or Plymouth Rock level of historic significance of people moving off Earth in a permanent sort of way. Does the current administration, would they prefer that historic outcome as opposed to whatever they're going to get with the current very expensive way? And I want to lay those two options before them. If they say, you know what, we are an administration of big ideas. We want America to be great again. And we want to accomplish big things, not just incremental, yes, let's keep doing the expensive government way, and eventually one day we're gonna get there. But if they want to go bold, I've got a plan. And so the question is, can I actually get the ear of somebody to be able to pose that question? Do you want bold, or do you want just mediocre? Because I think those are the choices.
And I don't know how you do that either, but I'm not sitting here with answers for you by any means. I don't think doing what DIRECT would do would work for you or anyone else, because why would you do what didn't work? And again, they did have engineering, they had muscle, they had access. But they went no place. And then, of course, Obama came in and canceled the program anyway. So, and then I think one of the guys got, we'll leave the personal stuff out of it. But I think it's a tall challenge in order you have set for yourself in order to get somebody's ear. And I don't believe everything in the world is impossible to accomplish. Look, I believe that I'm going to see a cure for cystic fibrosis, and I've been believing that for 32 years, and I haven't seen it, and I have not lost that vision or that dream or that absolute certainty that I'm going to be around to see that, and so is my son. So in a sense, I'm kind of where you are, and if I had the secret of how you get their ear, I would share it with you off air. I wouldn't give it out publicly.
And through the Space Development Network, I'm hoping that perhaps other people who are better, especially at social media, and maybe can develop, you know, 3D videos or things, you know, whatever. I'm hoping that if they like the plan for sustainable space development, that they can be able to help popularize it, which could help.
I think you have a fighting chance. That's about all I can say. I do think you will get media attention, but honestly, I would start on it early. I wouldn't wait until the last week when you know your plane lands in Orlando and you're getting ready to set up. I'd try to arrange all of this ahead of time, and I'd probably make a lot of phone calls rather than just do email. And you know, I would. The guys that I introduced you to down there do have media contacts. They have friends and people that are in the media. So if you made contact with them, then ask them for media contacts and see what they tell you.
And to be clear, I do have a plan B. If I fail, and if we head on the standard approach to lunar return, expensive government approach, my plan B is to then focus on habitation systems, because that is an area that I don't think there's been even enough space advocacy work to bring together into one habitat the hydroponics and the centrifuge and the machining and metallurgy and the humanities sorts of things. There's no, you know, Mars Desert Research Station, they're all exploration-oriented rather than development-oriented. And so I think that we can, even if it's going to be delayed and expensive to return to the moon if we do it the standard way, that the moment we arrive, I'm hoping that we can go for a sustained presence rather than, oh, let's have little sorties that last longer and let's go to the, you know, equators where we need maybe nuclear power and let's, you know, keep spending billions and billions of dollars. No, let's go with the intent of extended stay, perhaps lasting even years. So that's where the Unihab and the Moon Mars analog base at Tucson, that's where that comes in.
Kim, you're still on the line. Come back on.
Yes, I am.
This is your phone call.
Well, there was a lot of dialogue there that was good. While you were talking back and forth, because I've seen a piece on that, I looked up Space Development Network because I recalled seeing something with that name before. And you already have some challenges in social media because Space Development Network is taken on Facebook. And it's an Indian organization, which sounds familiar. I think I looked them up before, and there was an Indian organization working on this with that name.
Okay.
So I guess that's just a heads up there.
Yeah, thanks.
You might be able to work with them. It looks like they're you know, like so many, they're after the same thing. The pursuit of space colonization through a global cooperative effort. That's their about there.
That would fit mine pretty well, yeah.
Doug, maybe you should issue Bitcoin or something. What do you think?
I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. I'm still thinking from the last show. But.
and Thunderclap. I don't know if you've heard of Thunderclap, but your inflatable thing would probably adapt well to Thunderclap. So,
what is Thunderclap, Kim?
Oh, somebody else told me about it just a couple of months ago. Pavel, my volunteer in Russia. It's made to adapt to Twitter mostly. You set up an event so that as the event nears, you have a network of people who collectively promote it, and so you get it trending at the right time. Let me go to it. It's Thunderclap. It allows you to focus your promotion on a particular thing at a particular time, which is a lot more effective when you're a very small organization. It's thunderclap.it.
Okay.
And you can use their own website to put together the number of people you need to do that coordinated effort to get it trending elsewhere.
That's funny. For me as a physician, Thunderclap has a pretty bad connotation because it's a type of headache that is a real red flag. Like, you better get to the hospital and to the surgeon real quick if you have a Thunderclap headache. But
I've never heard of it. I've never heard of it, fortunately. Kim, do you have more to share with us, hopefully?
No, I'm not sure. I'm following it like I try to follow all of the big campaigns that have to do with the moon. This is definitely I'm going to call it a fringe effort, which doesn't mean it's bad, but it's definitely the minority report, shall we say?
Yeah.
In that sense, I think it has a role for that very reason. So I just continue to work and you know, accept that you're the rebel in this group.
Yeah. You too.
Yeah.
Anything else, Kim?
No, I'll clear the line.
Thank you very much for your call. Bye-bye.
Talk to you later.
Listeners, the line is available if you would like to call us. 1-866-687-7223. Have you used your email contacts with Bridenstine's office to tell them about your display at the Falcon Heavy launch or anything like that yet, or do you haven't done it?
Not yet. I guess I'd like a little bit more clarity on the time and location. That would be nice, but I do want to let them know about the plan for sustainable space development. I could at least do that.
He's got his hands full on his Senate hearing right now. So,
well, I sort of watched part of that hearing. It was very political, very very
yeah, of course.
Political, talking about all sorts of things having nothing to do really with space,
with NASA or anything.
Yeah. In a sense, I'm sort of glad because I don't know that anybody really asked him, okay, what are the plans for going back to the moon? They were talking about all sorts of other things. So there's still flexibility because my theory is that the moment the president, you know, the moment the decision is made and decisions are coming out, and especially when the president has a presentation about this is our plan, very difficult for a politician to change their plan because they looks like they're waffling or flip-flopping. So I'm happy for any little bit of time available to still make the case for a cost-effective transportation system to the moon that is cost-effective enough where it could reasonably transition to commercial operations, strictly commercial operations. And I don't see SLS and Deep Space Gateway as being a path that could very easily transition to commercial operations. It's like ISS. We're having a hard time transitioning that to full commercial operations. Probably never will. You almost need to start from scratch. And I would rather we develop the moon lunar transportation in a way that we could transition, because I think there's arguably an easier case for a market there than there is for a market at Mars.
what else was on your agenda? Because I know we've gotten sidetracked. What else did you want to make sure you talked about today?
Yeah, so I think, you know, after the launch of the Falcon Heavy, then my role as space advocate begins to change significantly, and that is I really want to aim towards the Kickstarter campaign for the construction of a UNIHAB. So the concept is that for $20,000 to $30,000, we could go ahead and pay these companies that produce the children's what do they call it, bounce houses.
Uh-huh.
And to say, here is a design and for the UNIHAB, and can you, you know, cut and sew together the vinyl to go ahead and create it? And they say, yes, we've done that many times. Give us the plans, and they do it again. So it's just a matter of, if you have the money, you can have the professionals go ahead and make this. However, as it currently stands, I do have a design for the UNIHAB that I have developed myself. But it's just very functional and not, I'm concerned that it just looks like a big pancake. And the reason why it looks a pancake is because it has a flat roof, which means putting regolith, you know, lunar dirt on top of it, means that you don't need to 3D print it on, or you don't need to construct anything. It just lays on the surface of a flat roof, and it's not going to slough off. But a big flat piece of dirt doesn't strike me as something that's going to generate a great deal of attention from the public. And so I this last week I've reached out to a number of universities that have space programs, and I have spoken with them by phone. This is you know, people at Rutgers and UND and other places that have these space programs. And I've said I'd like to actually fund a modest challenge, a prize, for students to go ahead and design a new design of UNIHAB that looks better in design than mine, and yet there is certain criteria that I've identified that it needs to be able to meet. And I've the faculty, of course, are very positive about this idea because it gives a really cool challenge and a prize money to the winning students. And so that's one thing I'm working on. And then after I get freed up from, you know, after the launch of Falcon Heavy, I'm mentally freed up, then I'm planning on working with the Space Finance Group to go ahead and prepare for a Kickstarter campaign, working with the local chapter of the National Space Society at Tucson to be able to site it by Tucson. And then after it's sewn together by the professionals, going ahead and doing a public unveiling or inflation of the UNIHAB and seeking to get media exposure for this new approach to analog bases, the Moon-Mars analog base with starting with the UNIHAB. And then a series of Kickstarter campaigns to put in the hydroponics, the aquaponics, the furniture, the electronics and whatnot, the centrifuge, to where it becomes a sort of a functional analog base that would be able to illustrate what it would be like to support an initial crew of 8 people. So that's what comes after the launch of the Falcon Heavy. So that's going to take me through probably much of 2018. And then from there, we could go beyond the UNIHAB to actually the rest of the base. So that would be mock-ups or preferably actually functional telerobots, probably working with some robotics programs at universities. Sort of like the Mars Society has the University Robotics Challenge, something similar to that. I did meet Dr. Angel Abu Madrid. He heads up the Space Resources Program at Colorado School of Mines. I met him at the League Conference, and I shared with him my concept for harvesting, telerobotically harvesting ice. And I would say he was very, extremely pleased with with those concepts. And so I think that we've established a relationship that's going to be very productive, working with Colorado School of Mines in that respect. The cool thing is that the Moon Mars Analog based at Tucson is a full-scale mock-up with a full-scale Unihab, and I will already have the full-scale lander. So when we do the public inflating of the Unihab, we'll have the full-scale lander already there in the background, and probably some mock-ups of the telerobots as well. So that's that. Any questions about the Unihab or Moon Mars Analog Base?
I'm not getting any at the moment, but you've got your work cut out for you. I think what people need to do is visualize what you're talking about a lot better. Are you able to put pictures or images up on the blog of do you have images of what you want to do?
Yeah, so I've created my own images. They're not really cool 3D rendered things, but they're things that I've been able to do with my capabilities. So I've got the images of the lander. Now I've got photographs of the actual mock-up of it. So I'll be putting those up. For the Unihab, I have it's sort of a blueprint type of drawing, sort of top-down drawing. So I'll go ahead and put that up as well. I do have a fairly decent image of what the full Moon Mars Analog Base would look like. So what's interesting is there is a radio station in Poland, of all places, and they've created this interesting complex of buildings using what's called monolithic construction. These are domes that you inflate a hemisphere and then you spray on cement to make these really rigid, singular buildings. And they have a whole bunch of these hemispheres all connected together, and that's close enough to what I'm talking about. That I took a picture of their facilities and sort of photoshopped it onto a lunar landscape, and I'm pretty happy with how that looks. So that can show what it is that we're talking about with the Moon Mars Analog Base. I've got images of like centrifuges and lunar greenhouse and things like that to illustrate what those would look like. So I have quite a few images that can illustrate the concepts to help people understand.
So you're going to be pretty busy for a while.
Yeah. My space advocacy work is definitely going to continue. And now with the Space Development Network, this is I'm hoping to pull in, and I'm starting to pull in a number of people that have interest in different areas. Like, for example, virtual reality. I've now got a fellow who's joined the Space Development Network who's his company works with virtual reality, and he's working with me on that. So I want to go ahead and pull together people who are interested in the VR side of things to have a phone teleconference and do a write-up of what could be done both within the Moon Mars Analog Base as well as the lunar or Martian base in terms of using VR. I have dance, strangely, is sort of an area, one aspect of it that seems to be moving forward that I'm working on, and there's many other aspects as well. So that's where the network really comes in, is getting people to join the network who have different interests and saying, hey, I have an interest in, let's say, cooking. Well, we need to figure out how do you go from growing the food in the greenhouse to actually turn that into a meal within the habitat. And so what plants do we need to plant? What can be grown in a hydroponic sort of setting? And then how many of what types of plants do we need to sustain an ongoing menu that has enough variety and yet provides the caloric, all the nutritional needs of the crew of eight? And probably, I'm guessing from that, is going to come a lunar cookbook, which would be an interesting little aspect of it.
You have what maybe the last question of the day, and this is from Bethany, and Bethany is in Las Vegas, and she says, Doug, I've gone to your website, spacedevelopment.org, and there's something on there about Western Skies broadband. I'm not picking up what you think is there. Do I have the right website address, or can you explain?
Yeah, my apologies. I've been trying to work with the current owner of spacedevelopment.org, and I expect within the next 12 to 36 hours we will get a redirect page to direct over to my current page that has information. But I am wanting to move to spacedevelopment.org. But as for the time being, if you go to developspace.info, that's where the plan for sustainable space development is located.
Okay, but that will soon go to the other website.
Yeah, spacedevelopment.org.
Okay, so when I write up the summary, I'll put developspace.info and the other one there as well.
Yeah, I've already, I'm not sure, have I posted that on the blog? I think I sent it out at the beginning.
I don't know, you sent it out, but I haven't seen anything come in on the blog post. So I don't know if you posted it on the blog yet, but feel free to do so by all means.
So let me just mention about the Space Development Network, because I would like to encourage the listeners to join it. Let me explain a little bit about this. This is a type of space advocacy organization that's fairly different in nature and purpose than other space advocacy organizations. Most space advocacy organizations are sort of a society, that is, people who have interest in Mars or people who have interest in the moon or whatever, planetary exploration, that they join, and then there's like conference and there's newsletters and things like that where people associate with each other in a sort of a big umbrella sort of format where people come with their own ideas and they talk to each other, and there's the leadership who's sort of guiding and showing things. The Space Development Network would be different in that it would be a network. It would be in working towards a specific plan, that is the plan for sustainable space development. So the what it is that people would join, and in the process of joining, if you go to developspace.info and you look on the bottom where it says join the network, when you join the network, it does a Survey Monkey form in which you fill it out, and when you go through it, you get some contact information, but it also specifically asks, what are your interests and your talents or your skills? And that information will be used by the network to help organize people into teams that will work on different aspects of the plan. I would like to mention that the Space Development Network will be free to join indefinitely. The goal is to try to bring in as many different people into the network, and reaching well beyond the regular space advocates who are maybe interested in rockets, but really even pulling in people who are interested in the humanities. And because once you start living off Earth, there's all sorts of things. There's the arts that could be involved. There's music. There's all sorts of things. And so it would be a broad variety of people that I would like to invite into the network. However, it's a working group, and that is the network is not intended just to, you pay your dues and you get to be sort of, I was going to say entertained, but that's not a good word, but you'll be informed about what's going on with this organization. No, it's a working group, and that is, you join for free, and you get connected with other people, and then there's like phone teleconferences or different projects that individuals can volunteer their work towards refining the plan with whatever talents and interests that they have. And the requirement in order to remain a member of the network is not to pay your annual dues, but to participate and to donate your time in order to move the plan forward. The requirements for each year is about 6 hours per year, so it's about 1 hour every 2 months. So it's not a burden to remain an active member of the Space Development Network. But we don't want people just to join, just to be fed information. We want people to join to actually help move the plan forward. And so the requirements are minimal, but they will be enforced, in that if people join and they're not really contributing to move things forward, well, the network is not the place for them. We want people to join together to actually move things forward. That's the whole purpose of the network.
And they can join when the website has been moved over to the new domain.
Well, actually, they can join now if they go to developspace.info. If you look down at the bottom, there's a link there to join. So they can join at this moment. And I just encourage people to do it. It's easy to forget. You know, it's like, oh, that sounds cool, but then days go by and then you didn't join. So if you're listening to this now, check out the website. Figure, do you want to join for free? Go ahead and click fill it out. It takes all of 5 minutes, and you'll be part of the network, and then I'll go ahead and contact you, and we'll get you going.
You have a final question that came in again from Adrian. Let's face it. What does he say here? Let's face it. The likely fastest and quickest way to get the U.S. government to declare a back-to-the-moon manned program mission before 2020, regardless of cost, is to get China to announce a manned lunar mission by 2020. Beyond the potential for a U.S.-Russia-ESA cooperative deep space gateway project that perpetuates the current ISS status quo, all else is very speculative. After this date, the elections might determine the outcome. Short of that, any other ground floor movement aimed at the government to do so will be mostly ignored unless it can promise to elect many politicians. Ha ha. A better chance would be to convince Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk to join forces and combine their effort to privately form an industrial lunar Mars development corporation. All our other combined efforts mainly lack lobbying and economic backing, thus likely doomed to be ignored. And in terms of concrete for lunar construction, has anyone demonstrated that can even function in a vacuum due to water sublimation, etc.?
So a whole lot of things there. I'm going to agree with him that if China were to set its sights on the moon, clearly, I mean, they've already said that it's in their long-term plans, but if they set, you know, we're going to be there 2020, yeah, I actually think that could well light a fire underneath NASA and help focus things and make things more efficient. So I'm inclined to agree with that. However, that's not something that any of us have any control over. That's the decision of the government of China. So all we have to do is sort of wait and see what happens there. In terms of it being done strictly privately, that is most definitely a possibility. And that's where I think this whole UNIHAB and Moon Mars Analog Base project can really come in. Because I don't know that Elon is working very specifically about what the initial habitats would look like. I don't know that Bezos is doing that. And so if we work together to show how people can land on the surface of the moon or Mars and already have a habitat set up and it's fairly sustainable and they're able to extend their stay, it could really help bring some reality to the surface aspects of what they're working on. So I think that could be actually something that we could contribute to. In terms of concrete, I don't get into concrete. I'm not really excited about construction projects because I think that if we can go with inflatables and we can push dirt, that's not going to slough off because the roof is flat, then I don't see the need to go through the extra steps of constructing. So I'm not real keen on lunarcrete or anything like that.
What would you like to say and leave us with today? What would be our takeaways from our conversation and discussion?
Really, the only takeaway is just the final appeal to people. I'd just like to invite you to join the Space Development Network. Check out the websites, join. There is really it's minimal. It doesn't cost you anything. And if you would like to do more than just listen to the Space Show, but you'd like to go ahead and actually get involved and help move things forward, then please join the Space Development Network.
Is there a consequence or punishment for not joining?
Well, you simply stop. Not joining?
Yes.
No, you'll have my scowl, but that's about it.
So you're there's no downside?
Well, I mean, you're not helping move the future forward, so I consider that a downside.
Okay.
I really think a lot of space advocates, they're sitting on their duff, and if I can be an example of somebody who tries to move things forward, I hope I'm an example for other space advocates to not just consume but actually produce. So
yeah,
this is one way to do that.
I think you are. So whether who knows where it all ends up. I certainly don't know, but you certainly are doing your very, very best to be creative and move the ball forward. There's no doubt about that.
Yep, I'm trying.
As Yoda said, not to use the word try. So you can look up his exact quote.
Okay.
So I won't bother people with that trite quote, but I have never forgotten it. And I think Yoda was on to something. So look it up, Yoda's quote on the word try.
Try, okay.
Yeah, and then you'll never use it again. So it's basically either there is no try, you either do or don't do.
Oh, try.
Yeah.
I said dry.
No, try, because you used the word I'm trying. So
yeah.
So according to Yoda, there would be no trying. You either do or don't do.
Well, I'm a doer.
So so try needs to come out of your vocabulary then. You don't want to offend the galactic cosmos philosopher just, you know, while you're trying to get started here, do you? So pay attention to Yoda and you'll continue to move the ball forward.
Thank you.
We will talk soon, and I hope that the Falcon Heavy launches for a lot of reasons, but if you are going to be down there with something, maybe we can work something out for a December 31st program as a call-in or do something. I think it'd be a lot of fun and different.
Yeah.
I was thinking if I do the show on December 31st, it would kind of be a space New Year's resolution show.
Mm.
So, just for fun, kind of lighthearted. And then we could, have a feature with you at your display if they still let it stay up.
Yeah, yeah.
So stay in touch, my friend.
All right. Thanks for having me on the show.
All right.
Really
listeners,
your work.
Tomorrow, Dr. Greg Autry is with us. So he was the head of the Trump landing team on space policy for the start of the Trump administration. He's a business professor at USC. In Los Angeles, and you definitely want to hear what Greg has to say. And Doug, if you're at work on Tuesday night, but you could ask him all about a real lunar policy coming out of this administration. He would be the guy to ask more than anyone else. I'll ask him for you.
Okay.
See what he has to say. Thank you, Doug. Listeners, thank you for your email. Kim, thank you for your call. Everybody have a great week. Keep looking up. Goodbye from Doug, goodbye from David, and goodbye from the Space Show.